You're listening to a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To find other episodes of The View and to subscribe to this podcast, visit questformeaning.org/VUU.
Good morning and welcome to The View, our live UU webcast that happens every Thursday. Some of our regulars are not here. However, we do every month have a kind of a check-in with what is happening with the Organizing Collective for Black Lives of UU. Let me introduce our two guests. The Reverend Carlton Elliott Smith is the Congregational Life Staff for the UUA Southern Region and a member of the Organizing Collective for Black Lives of UU. And we also have with us Leslie McFadden, who is the founder of the Ferguson Response Network. Thank you very much for being here. And Leslie, I would love to start with you because I just saw, I've been kind of out of touch, but I saw that something big with the Department of Justice and the leaders in Ferguson happened. Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, so the Ferguson City, hi everyone, and thanks for having us back on the show. But yeah, the Ferguson City Council voted to accept the Department of Justice plan to overhaul the police department in Ferguson. So it's big news in that they had been fighting this pretty strongly up until this point, even going so far as to reject the offer or the the offer from the Justice Department to comply and avoid heavy fines and also getting sued pretty much for civil rights violations. And once they rejected that, which was last month, Attorney General Lynch basically said, great, if you are rejecting our offer, then we will sue you and we'll see you in court. And so this is kind of the second round of that. I think they didn't expect her to call their bluff, which doesn't make any sense whatsoever, but they are now going to be working with the consent decree. I should say that lots of other cities are under consent decrees right now. Baltimore is under one. Cleveland is under one. So this is not something new, and it certainly does not magically make problems disappear with regard to justice and police departments. But I think for Ferguson, it's a referendum on the events that led up to Mike Brown's murder, and then obviously the state's response to the people of Ferguson as they rose up in opposition to them. So that's the latest news on that. So they just did that. So I think it's like a 127-page agreement. So they have like new guidelines for training officers, and I'm going to quote here, reorienting Ferguson's use of force policies towards de-escalation and avoiding force, end quote. So.
It sounds like something that really isn't that radical. It's just sort of the way it should be, but it is radical in that often the way things should be are not.
Correct. Yes.
So, Carlton, what is going on where you are?
Well, we just got the news yesterday of the decision by Hennepin County attorney in Minnesota, Mike Freeman, with regards to the determination that there weren't going to be grand juries for cases involving police shootings, which is tremendous news and represents a huge victory for so much of the work that's been going on there with regards to the Jamar Clark shooting by the police officers there, and actually both Leslie and I had a chance to be there in solidarity with the amazing work that the activists and organizers for Black Lives of Minneapolis are doing. Of course, they shut down the 4th Police Precinct, and we had a chance to be on site there, and Leslie especially was a tremendous support as they were beginning to organize around the shutdown and the takeover of City Hall in anticipation of the takedown of the occupation in front of the 4th Police Precinct. And this is just a tremendous victory, as we know that the grand juries and so many of them, pretty much all of these cases that we can think of, has been in solidarity and been unwilling to press the police officers involved in these horrific shootings, including Jamar Clark's in Minneapolis, have been unwilling to bring them to justice or hold them to account for their actions. So I think there's just tremendous a tremendous sense of celebration and new possibilities for justice that are now emerging in the wake of this. And certainly our hats go off to Unitarian Universalists who are deeply involved in Black Lives Matter of Minneapolis, including Lena K. Gardner, who also serves with us on the Organizing Collective for Black Lives of UU, Gioronsky Riley, who's Meg Riley's child, and is very much involved as well. So it was a great, great day yesterday, and we're very excited about that. I imagine Leslie's got something to add to that as well.
We'll claim those folks as Church of the Larger Fellowship people, too.
There you go.
I'm totally going through that. That's so awesome. The joy we feel for them is huge.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely huge. I think that, you know, it's amazing that it is being enacted for this particular case with Jamar Clark's death, but I think the larger implication of Mike Freeman, who is the Attorney General in Minneapolis and Hennepin County, saying that, you know, this can't be the norm any longer. These secret grand juries, when it comes to police shootings and investigations, and they need to be more transparent, and that the public needs to be more aware of what's going on. So I think that the larger piece of this is the narrative that activists on the ground in Minneapolis have been pushing for so long, which is the need for this additional oversight and transparency within these investigations, and that you know, that Mike Freeman heard them. And I think that it's a real testament to the power of organizing, grassroots organizing, and continued pressure on the state and those in power to change. So, yeah.
Yeah, over the past, I don't know, like 20 years, there has been sort of this thing that I've heard from so many liberals, especially younger liberals, that, you know, like protest really doesn't change anything. And boy, it sure feels like Minneapolis right now is becoming almost a case, is becoming a case study for how it really can make a difference. I mean, I would assume that the understanding is that none of this would have happened without people going down there, putting their bodies out there and raising their voices. Is that kind of that this happened because it was the right thing to do?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's not so different from, you know, any of the other places where people have put their bodies and their lives on the line, whether we're thinking about, you know, Rosa Parks and the Montgomery bus boycott, or crossing the bridge from Selma to Montgomery. I mean, all of these are, you know, actions that have taken place over time where people have been at real risk and people have shown up for justice. So salute, you know, again, those local Unitarian Universalists involved with Church of Larger Fellowship. Yes, Bob, indeed. We're so happy for that. As well as those who came from other parts of the country and who are doing similar work in other parts of the country. I know that the weekend that we were there after Thanksgiving, Barbara Gayden from the congregation down in St. Louis, you know, in Ferguson area, showed up. As well, and others, you know, who have been deeply involved. Those congregations who had Black Lives Matter signs out in front of their congregations across the country. I'd say, you know, all of us working together have helped build this momentum, so it's a victory that we can all celebrate together, and definitely without, and people have said, you know, oh, but I got late to the airport, or I couldn't get to work on time, or this, that, and the other. But it's true that that it's necessary to interrupt conversations and to interrupt narratives, so to create the space for something, some new possibilities to come forward. And certainly this is what this change represents.
Yeah, and I think that it's, you know, speaking to the idea of protest and what the power that it has in different spaces. Bob alluded to some huge happenings on Super Tuesday in both Chicago and in Cleveland. In Chicago, ousting Anita Alvarez, by Anita, from office, which is a huge accomplishment for an incumbent Democratic, longstanding public servant in a city like Chicago to be ousted. And I think there's, and also in Cleveland, where Tim McGinty, Tim, has also been ousted. And I think it's interesting in both of those cases, a few things that are really hallmarks of the movement for Black Lives and this iteration of what protest means in different spaces is that they were able to launch these campaigns without endorsing another candidate, which is really, really huge to think about the implications of that, because what it does is it continues to allow these organizers to hold whoever holds that office continually accountable. They're not tied to a specific person, because as we fight the system, we recognize those all that are involved in it need to be held accountable. And so it's really amazing. And I would also just mention that in Minneapolis and Cleveland and Chicago and really all over the country that we see young Black queer women standing up in the front lines planning these actions. In Chicago, these women worked with $1,000 budget. I just want to say that out loud again. $1,000 budget over the last 3 months to undertake this huge, huge job of getting Anita Alvarez out of office. And they did an amazing job of boots on the ground in the face of established organizers telling them their method was not going to work, it wasn't going to get to the people, it wasn't going to be effective. And it's just really validating to see their efforts pay off in such a huge way and to see the support that they received from the people of Chicago. So, yeah.
I know we have a lot to talk about, but I would love to hear more about what you think specifically they were doing that was effective. But I don't want to derail.
I think it actually ties really well into this concept of risk, right? Which is what Carlton and I really wanted to talk about a lot today.
Let's go with that then.
Does tie well into. What worked well in Chicago is what always works well in organizing. You know, you lift up the voices of those most affected, you clarify the things that you want to happen, and you make it clear that interrupting the status quo is what needs to happen in order for the message to get out. So to me, everything that they did was under those guidelines of organizing, and it's really critical that people understand what that means, you know, when I say interrupting the status quo. So they did not traditionally say, okay, who's opposing Anita Alvarez, let's get with them, let's just see if they're going to be good for us, and let's put our efforts behind supporting them. This wasn't a campaign that was for somebody. It was against a specific individual who has proven time and time again that they were not standing with the people of Chicago. So that's what's made it so powerful, and I think we saw this in Cleveland as well. With Tim McGinty, it was definitely like, you know, we had a hashtag worst campaign that was going for him in the fall, because he truly is horrible, horrible prosecutor. And so I think that those are the things that make it really critical. But there's risk involved in that, you know, because I think that established, especially the non-for-profit industrial complex, you know, they're not used to running campaigns that aren't in support of something, right? So there's a risk there for anybody looking to engage with these platforms and with these organizers that they're going to have to understand that things are different, right? They're going to have to approach their interactions differently. They're going to have to approach their engagement with these organizers differently, because if you're bringing your "this is how we've always done it" mentality into these relationships, it's never going to work. And that's where the risk is, right? For white folks, for organizers, for regular people to really challenge the way that they've decided to do things in the past and doing things differently. I think a lot of people don't get that in this work, we create a better world not just by what we do, but with how we do it, right? So it's really, really important that people understand, you know, when I am building with organizers around the country, I'm nourished. You know, we are creating intentional space where our humanity is lifted up in the actions that we do, in the way we choose to interact with each other and with the world. And I think that a lot of non-for-profit industrial complex machines and also just general institutions are focused on the end result and don't put enough emphasis on what gets us there. Because the part that what gets us there, that's the transformative piece. And that's where the risk is for people, to understand that they have to approach things differently than they have before. And there's risk there, because you're going to have people that are entrenched in your organizations pushing back, "Well, we never do it that way. we always have this information 7 months in advance. Well, if you're working with organizers that are reacting on the fly to real instances of police violence and state violence, then that's a flexibility that needs to be addressed. And if you're going to engage with people, it has to be on terms that work for them. So that's what I would say, just initially talking about the whole risk piece and how it relates to this amazing job that has been done around the country by organizers.
So Leslie, something, on this whole topic of doing things in a very different way than it's been done before, a question that I have received, especially from people in their, I'd say like 70s and 80s, people who were really involved with civil rights in the 50s and 60s, they're trying to put Black Lives Matter sort of into that framework, you know, in terms of, well, you know, like I would love to send a check, and back in my day I could send a check to the, you know, to the SLCC or, you know, whatever. How is there a simple way to explain sort of how Black Lives Matter is organized? If that makes any sense.
Absolutely. There is a really simple way. The Movement for Black Lives is a collection of real people that are committed to working towards Black liberation. That's it. There's no additional thing that needs to be put in. It's made up of individual people. It's made up of multiple organizations. It's made up of people that are in other organizations. And it is a commitment to Black liberation and a set of principles that go along with that, which is, you know, ones that we've mentioned here many times, including the fact that all Black lives matter. So it's eschews respectability politics. And I think one thing to think about in the context of the civil rights movement is that, you know, movements build on each other, right? So we have inherited a legacy of the fight for Black liberation that goes back probably to the dawn of time. And so what means is we have to be transformative in our work. We can't do what was done. We need to look at what was done and build upon it. And that's what the Movement for Black Lives is. It's the next iteration of the fight for Black liberation, and it's taking the lessons that were learned in previous generations and building on them and doing things different, new, with the same goals in mind.
And I would add to that it's interesting because I was at a gathering of Unitarian Universalists in Florida this weekend where I was leading a workshop about Black Lives Matter and Unitarian Universalism. And this exact same question came from one of the folks attending the workshop. And as has been often said before, you know, Black Lives Matter is a leader-full movement where some people want to frame it as a leader-less movement, but it's full of leaders. And as I said to, and some people were saying, it's like, well, what if we don't necessarily agree with this action that's happening over here in this city or this group? And as I said to the folks there, it's like, I would love to be able to say to any Black person, well, you can just go to any Unitarian Universalist congregation across the country, and I'm sure that they will, you know, look out for you. They're going to treat you fairly. You'll feel included. You'll feel accepted. And I can't say that because each congregation has its own different personality, its own history, its own commitments, its own way of being. And I'd say that that's true inside of Black Lives Matter as well. Different chapters and different groups that are organizing under that banner have different ways of being too. And to Leslie's point, the emphasis is on what does it mean to be in relationship. And so the opportunity is for people who are looking at becoming involved in a local level or even supporting something maybe in another part of the country. It's like you need to be in relationship and be in conversation with those people to find out, you know, is this something that we're aligned with, or to really get a depth of understanding. Some folks want to make it seem like, you know, well, this isn't the way it was done, you know, years before. We have to remind them that there wasn't unanimity during the civil rights era. The Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee had a very different approach from the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. So there's some fantasy that gets projected, you know, on the way things were in the past. But if you really look at it, Dr. King he didn't have a national holiday back then, and wasn't, you know, fully recognized or accepted for the work that he was doing, even within the African American community. So I think we have to complexify, you know, the situation and help people understand at a greater depth.
And I think, too, speaking to, like, this, helping people understand what this new era of civil rights movements is about is also kind of dissecting this notion of freedom and dissecting this notion of power as well, right? So one thing I always like to mention is that I think people have this general notion that getting closer to the privileges that white males have in our society is the goal of a civil rights movement. And it's such a false way of looking at what we're trying to accomplish here. So what we're trying to do is get rid of this hierarchy that exists, not to ascend a ladder so that we're replacing those that are already in power. I think it's really hard for people in the civil rights who are familiar with the civil rights area to get that distinction, because during the civil rights era, it really was about some fundamental equality issues that needed to be addressed at a federal level, at a legal level. And so as we move into this separate movement that we have now, that's an extension of that, we're challenging this idea of the power structure and really looking to disrupt the status quo with the work that we do.
I see that we're halfway through the hour, so I'm going to ask everyone, including our guests, let's go around and introduce yourself again and give your title or where you're from or all of that. I'm Joanna Fontaine Crawford. I'm the minister at Live Oak UU Church in Austin, Texas.
I'm Aisha Hauser, and I'm the director of religious education at East Shore Unitarian Church in Bellevue, Washington.
I'm Bob LaValle. I'm a seminarian at Meadville Lombard Theological School and an interim minister at the Church of the Larger Fellowship, dialing in from Buffalo, New York.
I'm Leslie Mack, and I'm founder of the Ferguson Response Network and also a member of the Black Lives of UU Organizing Collective.
And I'm Carlton Elliott Smith. I am an ordained Unitarian Universalist minister serving as one of the congregational life staff for the UUA Southern Region and also a member of the Black Lives of UU Organizing Collective.
So, Leslie, you mentioned that you and Carlton had talked about risk, and I would love to hear more about that in a very tangible way. I've been watching all of the people who are going into the Trump rallies, which I think is a very, very literal, example of risk. Oh, and before we get to that, let me ask you this. Something that I've been talking about with people is that all of the things, the advances that we are seeing with the movement for Black Lives, and then what's happening and it's not even so much Trump as the fact that he and his followers can be so just openly racist and sexist. And I'm saying, those things are not disconnected. The open racism that we're seeing, the just unapologetic, is a response to the fact that our culture is changing. Things are happening. Is that your impression?
Well, I think I would say first that I think if you asked the average Black person, they would say it's been pretty open and in their face all this time. So I think when you say out in the open, I think that's just that white folks are kind of like, whoa, this is happening. And, these aren't people that just decided to be racist today. So I've dealt with plenty of people who have said horrible things to me in protest action and in other rooms as well. So to me, it's not surprising. I will say I would draw a direct line through all of this and the Trump candidacy, generally speaking, as a backlash to President Obama's presidency, generally speaking. We saw the rise of the Tea Party, which created this atmosphere that allowed someone like Donald Trump to come in and take over the Republican Party in such a huge way. And I also blame the media in part because they have decided to allow this rhetoric to take center stage in this political process for a long time without doing some fundamental things that we expect the media to do, calling for platform and agenda items from candidates, which we have seen none of with regard to Mr. Trump. So I think there's a lot of factors that go into it, but I do think change is hard, and we always say that when you're used to privilege, equality seems like oppression. And so that's what we're seeing this backlash towards. But I don't think any of these people felt like they weren't like in love with black people prior to now. So I don't think that it's that much of a difference. Yeah, exactly. I think it's interesting seeing the rallies themselves. I think the fervent atmosphere is very interesting. It's very carnival-like. My husband went to one here in Michigan. He was doing some scouting for some other actions around the country, and just his reaction to it was very, you know, the thing that surprised him most was this assumption that if you were there that you agreed with everything, and so people would just start off these like horribly racist conversations with him, strangers, just by the nature of being in this space. So I found that to be really interesting. I think that's more of a sociological commentary than a political one, but I do think it's something to think about, how crowd mentality can affect things.
And I've been hearing reports about a kind of weird, people have described it as a spiritual trauma when they go to these Trump events as an observer and just can't, are just so overwhelmed, just traumatized by sort of the frankness and the frightening thing that they're seeing. So it's interesting.
Go ahead, Carlton.
Yeah, I was just gonna say that certainly President Obama's ascendancy is part of the backlash, and then I would also extend it even further back into history to the Southern strategy of the Republican Party that got going in the 60s, whereby which they aggressively went to the right and picked up those the people who were disaffected Southerners who weren't down with integration or desegregation or any of that. And so I'd say that, you know, over the course, if you, you know, look, take that broader lens of history, this is sort of like the natural outcome of like what got set up, you know, 50 years ago with regards to the Republican Party. And if you think about, you know, we went from, you know, Ronald Reagan, who was an actor, and now we got another actor who's, you know, Ted Cruz, who's a major contender for the Republican nomination, somewhat the likes of the second Bush administration, which was, you know, more or less given to him. And McCain Palin, I mean, you know, we were on a trajectory, and so this is sort of like where we end up, is with, you know, a candidate like Donald Trump emerging so strongly. But it's been something that's been worked and tapped into, this deep resentment. And like Leslie said, when equality looks like oppression, you know, there are people who can't believe, you know, that a black person is in the White House, and what does that say about them as white people? It's like, what, we don't get to call the shots all the time anymore? It's like really quite an affront to identity. And as our UU theologian, Dr. Tondeika, says, that people, often we're trying to have a conversation with people on a level of reason, but there are issues of identity that are much deeper than reason, and people will fight you tooth and nail around their identity. And white identity, you know, for people who have a deep investment in their superiority based on whiteness is very, very profound. And that's what I think we're seeing surface. So in such a huge way.
Yeah, superiority and power. I remember, I think it was last year we had a guest on, I believe it was Doug Mutter, who talked about the fact that President Obama is the first president in the history of the United States who was not elected by white males. White males did not elect him president. When you were hearing this thing of about his illegitimacy, it was because the people who had always decided the presidency didn't, for the first time ever.
Well, to me, when I'm watching what's happening with the Republicans, who thought, you know, it was such a, you know, they lived in their own delusion of how much power they actually have, the white males that control the GOP and Fox News, because what they thought was just aimed, and President Obama spoke to this, was just aimed at a black president. Talk about chickens coming home to roost and, you know, Frankenstein's monster. I mean, all this was exactly what they thought was only going to stay in one direction. And in a big way, it's a lesson in the interdependent web of life, and be careful what you unleash. And it's kind of scary. I feel like our country's like a heroin addict, and we're now hitting rock bottom? You know, I don't know if any of you have seen the meme. Has anyone tried turning America off and then on again? I mean, it feels like we're coming to a reckoning that's been in the works since the Revolutionary War and slavery. We finally having to come to terms with what we've created.
And I also like to always point out that, you know, the Democratic side is also problematic as hell. So, you know, it's easy to point to this GOP field and all of the issues surrounding it, especially with the media attention they've been able to garner, and not, you know, also attach these same lenses to the liberal and progressive movements that are taking place in the country. So we always want to make sure we're applying our critical eye to everything, because in truth, you know, none of these systems and processes were meant to accommodate black people or blackness. And so we are continually in this state of challenging institutions, systems, and organizations that were never meant to accommodate us as full human beings. And so that also lies in a risk position for organizations and institutions to confront that fundamental fact and then decide how they're going to address it. Are they going to change the way that they interact with black people and blackness? And what does that look like for each of them? And there's inherent risk in that, because it's, you know, a little bit of an admission that you've been derelict in the past. But there's a lot of healing that comes from that. And I know that when I've seen it work really well with institutions, it's been an incredible transformative process for them, for their members, and for black people that want to interact and be part of those institutions. And I think that that's really at the core of the work that we do with Black Lives of UU, is continually pushing our faith and our association to really look at the processes that we have in place and the way that we go about in the world of being UUs and pushing our agenda as a faith, and how that process and those institutional pieces fit within the movement for Black Lives, and for specifically for Black UUs, and how Black UUs are either honored or dishonored in those processes. So, and there's risk there. There's real risk. But when people say, you know, what can I do for Black liberation? You know, that's the most powerful thing that you can do for Black liberation, is to truly confront in your life, confront in yourself, confront in the institutions that you have power and voice in, and really decide where you're willing to take a risk and step up for Black people.
Go ahead, Aisha.
Well, I was just looking at your sign behind you, Leslie. White silence is what silence is white consent, and you're absolutely right that the Democrats, through history, being complicit is not better than being the it's you're joining the aggressor. So thank you for lifting that up.
I'd love to hear more about about risk and what does, because I think that we have I think there are certain things, like the protesters going into a Trump rally, where we can say, okay, that's risk, but I know that this is something much bigger. Can you speak to that?
Sure. So I think that oftentimes, especially when I'm speaking with white folks about like work in the movement and like what can be done, there seems to be a bit of a disconnect between wanting to step up for racial justice and social justice and then actually taking action. And the piece that's in the middle of there is this question of risk and what risk looks like. And it's really different for each person. But there comes a moment when you have to make a decision to either go with the flow or to push back against what's coming at you. And that is where we need more white people to step into the fray and decide that they are going to demand that things be done differently. And so as it relates to us here, as you use, I'll just use some general examples. So we have this presidential campaign for our for UUA president that's coming up, and I would ask, you know, what forums are people lifting up the needs of Black UUs as we embark on this search, right? Did the search committee ask those questions? I'm not saying they did or didn't, but I'm just pointing out some specific risk areas that people can decide to do things differently. And again, the power is in that work. You'll be surprised at how transformed institutions and individuals will be just taking that risk there. And then there's other risks that can be taken. You know, I talk all the time. I think I was speaking with my husband last week about some potential actions at Trump rallies, and he was expressing a hesitance to want to take over. You know, I think a lot of white males, especially in the movement, they're really cognizant of patriarchy and sexism and their white maleness, because it's something that's so ingrained. You really do have to come in with that awareness. It's really critical in order to really build with people. But there's a level of risk in putting yourself out there and saying, I'm going to step forward. I'm going to be okay. I'm going to take responsibility. I'm going to put myself out there. There's risk there, real risk individually, personally. There's potential for failure. There's potential for backlash. But it's nothing that black people don't, no risk that black people don't take on a regular basis. And so those are the places in our lives that we really have to decide, are we really willing to, what are we willing to risk? How are we going to show that that risk is being taken? And where are we going to assert ourselves in the fight for black liberation? And so when I say risk is real, it really is about, you know, where, figuring out where the risk is and then actually taking it. You know, is the risk in saying that even though we normally have this program set 7 months in advance, that if we want to engage with black people and black institutions, that we are okay with waiting until 4 weeks before, because that's what's going to work with these organizers and this movement and this interaction. And there's a risk there. You have a risk of lots of things, people not being happy with that, people being uncomfortable, people not liking that things aren't being done the way that they are. But if your response to black liberation and organizers and organizations is that this is how we've always done it, when you say that, know that inherent in that statement is, this is how we've always done it, and it's never accommodated you. And I'm unwilling to change to accommodate you, even though this system that I'm perpetuating never was meant to accommodate you and your needs. And I hope people can really understand, like, when you say this is how we've always done things, how it sounds to black people when you say that. It's like, okay, yeah, we know it's how you've already done things, and those things don't work for us. So where do we go from where do we go from there? That's where the risk point is for institutions and for white people, generally speaking, is to challenge that notion of this is how we've always done things, because most times we weren't taken into account in that always done things. So
yeah, and it won't always be easy or convenient.
Right.
Usually it won't.
Right, and so that's a natural segue into one of the other things we wanted to touch on this this edition of The View, which is some of the upcoming plans for our UUA General Assembly coming up in Columbus, Ohio. It's June 22nd or 26th, I believe. And it's very exciting because back in the fall, those of us on the Black Lives of UU Organizing Collective were invited by the Program Development Group to create a Black Lives track for General Assembly. And Alandria Williams and Leslie, Lena K. Gardner, and Kenny Wiley and I came together and actually polled some of the folks who are on the Black Lives of Unitarian Universalism closed groups for explicitly for Black Unitarian Universalists to see like what would interest people or what might draw people into our General Assembly, maybe people who had been more active in Unitarian Universalism before but couldn't figure out a way to be Black and Unitarian Universalist at the same time and still feel whole and included. As well as people who may not be that deeply involved in Unitarian Universalism currently. And all of this was an outgrowth of our participation, the participation of some of us at the Movement for Black Lives convening in Cleveland at Cleveland State University last July, for that last weekend in July, a very powerful experience. So we created this track of four workshop offerings during General Assembly that we're really excited about. And over the course of these, as we're leading up to General Assembly, we're going to take time during our time on The View to talk a bit about those. The first of those four program slots is going to be about the Movement for Black Lives convening and explicitly Black spaces. One of the things that was very, very powerful about the convening was that it was an intentionally, explicitly black space, so much so that even though there were some people who were white who had registered for the Movement for Black Lives convening, there was a separate track that was created for them in order to preserve the integrity of having it be a black space made up of 1,200 or 1,300 people. So, and we had Unitarian Universalists who were involved in that. Leslie's husband was involved, as well as Lane Campbell, in sort of creating space for the white allies to have their own kind of gathering in solidarity. But it was a really very powerful experience, and that's going to be something that's going to be risk-taking at this General Assembly, because we're going to have a couple of those program offerings in which we're going to segment people. People are going to have a chance to segment into an all explicitly black space, an explicitly other people of color space, and a white ally space. And we feel this is necessary because there's when we're in a conversation about anti-blackness, or if we're looking at our continuing work going forward, where we are in relationship to blackness is going to have something to do that, have something to do with where we locate ourselves and how we're going to do that work and how we're going to have those conversations. So the conversation's happening, and we want it to be those conversations to have integrity, very high degree of integrity. That might not be possible when we're inside of the white gaze, inside of white supremacy. And I was talking about this again at this workshop that I was helping lead this weekend to try to help people understand it. That you know, if you have a room full of women who are inside of a conversation, and a man comes into that room, there's something that's going to shift automatically just based on how the power, how we have a how we have patriarchy inside of our culture and how it's a male-dominated culture. There's going to be something that's going to shift. There's going to be some conversations that just won't happen because there is a man in the room with all those women. Similarly, you know, with regards to being inside of a white supremacist culture, if you have a room full of black people and a white person steps into the room, this it's going to affect, you know, what's going to happen in those conversations. So that's one of the risks we are taking, and we're hoping and intending to help inform our Unitarian Universalists who are going to be coming to General Assembly about that so that they can anticipate and begin to prepare now to take a risk and be in these distinct spaces. Leslie, I know you got something to add to that.
Yeah, actually, can I just say like how awesome, yeah. After last year's awful GA, like how awesome this is, it really, like, I'm getting kind of choked up, like how amazing it is after, what a great recovery after how things went down in Portland.
And kind of bouncing off that a little bit, Bob, I would make it really just to be super open and transparent is that it hasn't been easy. It hasn't been without stumbling blocks. It hasn't been without, you know, speaking truth to power and really confronting the institutions that exist within our faith and within our association, and continue to do that. So, you know, those of us on the organizing collective, you know, it's been painful at times. It's been, you know, combative at times, not within ourselves, but in confronting these things and really sticking to the principles that we have decided are important to us in this work. And I think that, you know, just speaking a little bit more about this particular session, we're going to hear from lots of Black UUs that went to the Movement for Black Lives convening, so that we'll get to hear directly from them about what that space was like and what happened there for them. And also, you know, just acknowledging the fact that Black Lives of UU wouldn't exist without that convening. You know, it was a rare opportunity that we had as Black UUs to be in a city, in a space together, talking about these issues that we face as Black people in our faith. And so, you know, to me, I would hope that that alone speaks volumes to the benefits and the need for explicitly Black spaces, because all of the work that we've done since this summer would not have happened without this space being created. And so we're really looking for this session, which will be open to all people to attend, for people to really come and listen and understand what the purposes are of explicitly Black spaces, what the power is in them, and to take that risk in understanding that without this need jerk rationale of, you know, segregation and segmenting and all of those, you know, buzzwords that come along with the notion of wanting to create explicitly black spaces. So that's really critical. The other thing I wanted to mention is that next Wednesday, the 23rd, we are going to be hosting a town hall meeting, an online town hall meeting. So that's going to be 8 p.m. Eastern time. And we are going to be talking about GA, generally speaking, and then a little bit more in depth about the work that we're continuing to do and what our plans are for the future. I think that there seems to have been a little bit of, like, I don't know, unintentional, you know, secrecy behind the collective. And so I've heard that kind of idea from people. And so we're looking to spend some time to come together and kind of dispel a few things and just let it be known why we came together, why we continue to come together, and our plans to kind of expand the collective itself to have some more voices. And you'll hear from other people as well, and we'll be doing that pretty consistently. And when we start talking about the other pieces of the programming, you'll see faces other than mine and Carlton and Lena and Kenny on here, which is really exciting because we really are taking the time with this program to lift up the voices of Black UUs, ones that you probably don't know, ones that people have never heard of, ones that do amazing work in their communities and their congregations. And so that's really important to us. And so we're going to start that really important work ASAP. I just want to mention that. I think we have hopefully we can send that link out. And then we also put out a statement a couple of weeks ago about supporting the Black Lives of UU track and specifically Black UUs coming to GA. So we have, amongst the collective, we've set a general goal of having 300 Black UUs at GA this year, which is a lot. Well, actually, it's not a lot, but it's a lot for GA. And so we're really hoping to challenge congregations and the UUA as well to really do whatever they can to remove the barriers that exist for Black people to attend things like GA. And I think that GA is definitely one of those areas where Blackness and Black people were not considered in the building of the framework of it, what it means, the costs associated with it, taking off time from work, the cost of housing, just coming in general, knowing that the average Black person, the average Black UU, is not as financially stable as the average white one. And so we're looking to really combat those obstacles. And one of the things that that was really critical in planning the convening this summer was the notion of looking at who we needed to be in the room and then planning all of our efforts around removing the obstacles that would stop them from being there. And I don't think that that's something that's been done at GA with regard to Black people, and so we're looking to change that as well.
Right. Carlton, you mentioned preparation. You know, you said prepare yourselves. In our last couple of minutes here, are there things that, for people who are planning on attending this GA, are there things that they can do to prepare themselves so that they get the most out of this track?
Yes, I'd say that one thing is to, as we have alluded to before, there is a Facebook group called Black Lives of UU that we encourage people to join and follow, because that's going to be one of the primary vehicles we're going to be communicating through in terms of, like, ways that people can prepare themselves. We're going to be doing some different webinar kinds of opportunities, probably through the Zoom platform or Google Hangouts. The town hall meeting next week is going to be part of that as well. So these are other ways that people are going to be able to keep informed about what's going on. And certainly people can communicate to us through the Facebook page as well. So that's going to be like our primary way of helping get the word out. Plus, we're particularly interested in those congregations that are in states close to Ohio, because we think that those are going to be the ones that are going to be most accessible, that might be within a day's drive or so of it. And we know that there's Black youth all over the country, of course, but we're going to be looking particularly at seeing how we can support and facilitate people from that immediate area. The other thing is that this is also in preparation for our General Assembly next year in New Orleans, which is also going to have a Black Lives emphasis as well, and a social justice emphasis.
And Aisha, I know that you have a particular recommendation for any white UUs coming to GA that will be doing.
Yes, I strongly recommend the work of Robin DiAngelo. She's actually going to be a VIEW guest in April. She coined the term white fragility. She also wrote a really provocative, I thought, great piece called White Women's Tears and the Men Who Love Them. And so she is an anti-racist white activist, and she speaks to well-meaning white liberals the best, because she's still telling them, you're still racist, you're still operating in white supremacy, get over yourself and step back. So I would strong, especially white folks who are going to be, you know, go to the Black Lives of UU track, please read, actually I wish every white liberal would read Robin DiAngelo's work.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank our guests, Leslie Mack and Carlton Elliott Smith. It is always such a gift when you join us. Thank you for being here. Next week on The View, the topic is Welcoming Young Atheists with guest David Breeden. Hope you can join us for that. Any last remarks, anyone? Okay. Thank you all for joining us.
This has been a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To find out more about the CLF, visit questformeaning.org.